This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Borobudur is an enormous Buddhist temple found on the Indonesian island of Java. In fact, it's not just an enormous Buddhist temple, it is the largest Buddhist temple on the face of the planet. It was and still is one of the most popular pilgrimage sites for Buddhists, and also one of the most popular tourist attractions in Indonesia, and it's been around for a very, very long time. Borobudur was built, we think, during the 8th century. It takes the form of a large, squat, squarish temple, almost like a half-built step pyramid with another dome-like section on top of that. It's got six square terraces, each smaller than the last, hence the pyramid-esque look. And then on top of that, it's got three more round terraces on top of the square part, hence the dome. Buddhist temples like this are sometimes referred to as stupas, a dome or mound-like building used for prayer and meditation by Buddhists. And when Borobudur was built, it had over 500 Buddha statues on it. There are still heaps and heaps of them there today, many of them sitting inside little stupas, little stone domes with holes that you can look through and see the statue. And the whole thing, right, is made of over 1.5 million blocks of volcanic rock, constructed without any mortar or anything. So very, very impressive structure. And a very beautiful one too. The exterior walls are decorated with intricate reliefs, thousands and thousands of them, that tell stories or reveal Buddhist teachings as you ascend the monument, climbing up from terrace to terrace. And these reliefs also very usefully depict ordinary, everyday scenes from day-to-day life in this region from back in the 8th century. And so have been of immense value to archaeologists and historians who have sought to learn more about this place and time in history. And as I've already sort of mentioned, it's absolutely huge. It's around 120 metres square at its base. And while it's only 35 metres high, it's still an enormous and very, very impressive structure, particularly considering its age and elements of its story, which we'll talk about as we get underway with it. So, this story, the story of Borobudur, it goes back, as I mentioned, to around the 8th century. We think we don't know exactly when it was constructed, but throughout the 8th and into the 9th century, many great Buddhist monuments were constructed in Java as the Buddhist religion spread throughout the region. Javanese Buddhism combined elements of traditional ancestor worship with aspects of Buddhism that had been brought in from India. Although these days, Buddhism is not particularly widespread in Java. These days, Java is overwhelmingly Muslim. You may be interested to learn, in fact, that the largest Muslim nation on earth in terms of population isn't something like, I don't know, Iran or Saudi Arabia or nations that are, you know, very commonly associated with the religion in the public eye. The largest Muslim nation on earth is, in fact, Indonesia, or maybe Pakistan, depending on who you ask. They're neck and neck, roughly speaking, with over 230 Muslims each. But in any case, Islam wouldn't really take hold in Indonesia until the 14th century. And at the time that Borobudur was being built, this is obviously still centuries and centuries away. Back then, Buddhism was one of the major religions in Java, along with Hinduism. At some point, back in the 8th century, the Shailendra dynasty that ruled Java, they were going about building all of these Buddhist monuments. They were pretty keen proponents of Buddhism. And while we have firm historical records of some of these monuments, we don't have all that much to go on with Borobudur. In fact, Much of the origin story of Borobudur has been guessed at using the knowledge that we have of the Shailendra dynasty, as well as evidence that we have of other monuments built around the same time. Using that, we can infer details about the construction of Borobudur. The Shailendra dynasty, incidentally, they ruled what is known as the Mataram Kingdom, whose territory included central and eastern Java. The Mataram Kingdom was established when a bloke named Sanjaya took power in Java in the early 8th century. From there, the waters get a little muddy about the exact succession of events after Sanjaya. Some historians claim that Sanjaya taking power led to the rise of two separate dynasties, both claiming him as their progenitor and sort of coming into conflict with each other. One dynasty, the Shailendra dynasty, was Buddhist, while the other, the Sanjaya dynasty, was Hindu. But there are other historians who throw this entire theory in the garbage. They say, no, the Sanjaya dynasty never actually really existed, and these religious differences actually were contained within the one dynasty. They didn't actually constitute separate dynasties. Whatever the case, suffice to say, the ruling classes in Java at this time in its history were very, very strongly influenced by the religions and the cultures of the Indian subcontinent. Whether they were Buddhist or Hindu, these religions, these cultures had been brought from India. Ancient Indians had been visiting Java and places like it for centuries. There were commercial links, there were diplomatic links that tied the regions together. With the Indian merchants that came and visited places like Java, came their religions and their cultures and their customs. And this meant that Buddhism as a religion, along with all of its cultural trappings as well, became a bigger and bigger part of life in Java. Buddhism, of course, originated in India. We talked about that in Monuments Episode 6, Mahabodhi Temple, Get Across It. That was the place where Buddhism was effectively founded. And this cultural and religious uptake of Buddhism across Java was manifested with the construction of great monuments like Borobudur, even if the details of its actual construction are, as I say, a little scarce. The best guess that we can make is that it was built in stages across the span of half a century or so, which is a long time. But then remember, you know, 1.5 million blocks of volcanic rock. That's not appearing out of thin air. And was probably finished up. This temple was probably completed in the early 9th century. Now, interestingly, there are two other Buddhist temples that were also built nearby and presumably around the same time. They're known as Mendut and Pawon. And these three temples, right, Mendut, Pawon, and Borobudur, they are built in a straight line. You can draw a straight line between the three of them. And so there may have been some relationship between the three, but of the three, Borobudur is by far the grandest and, of course, the largest. In fact, the grandeur of Borobudur may have been in direct response to Javanese Hindus, the rivals, the religious rivals of the Buddhists, constructing a mighty Hindu temple not far from Borobudur known as Prambanan. Whatever the case, Borobudur remains an exquisite example of the cultural syncretism that took place in Java at this time as Buddhism became a bigger and bigger part of the lives of the people there. But it wasn't to remain this way forever, and despite Buddhist pilgrims visiting Borobudur for centuries after it was first constructed, in time its status and influence as a Buddhist monument began to wane. Now, there are a few reasons for this. Firstly, Borobudur was located near not one but two volcanoes. It still is, in fact. Neither the volcanoes nor Borobudur have shown any indication of wanting to pack their bags and move away. And these volcanoes had a bad habit of erupting throughout the 10th and 11th centuries, meaning that the Mataram Kingdom actually moved its capital away from the volcanoes and therefore from Borobudur. And this obviously would have affected the monument's popularity, of course, as people were drawn away from it with the shifting of the kingdom's capital. But more importantly to the decline of Borobudur was, of course, the uptake of Islam across the island of Java in the 14th century and beyond. Islam arrived in Java much earlier, around the time that Borobudur was built, in fact, in the 8th and 9th century. However, it didn't really get much of a foothold on the island until centuries later, when deeper trading links were made with the Islamic world in the late medieval and early modern periods. And around this time, the people of Java steadily converted to Islam, and as they did so, Borobudur's religious and cultural importance steadily waned. And with fewer and fewer people visiting it, with fewer and fewer people maintaining it, with fewer and fewer people interested in it, someone else decided to step in and take over the place, Mother Nature. Nature reclaimed Borobudur after it was more or less abandoned, and between thick ashfall from the nearby volcanoes and the rainforest moving back in to overtake the monument, Borobudur more or less just disappeared off the map. We've had this sort of thing happen before in previous episodes, the Nazca lines, for instance, or Petra monuments episodes 3 and 5, get across them. These monuments were at one point or another just kind of forgotten about. Some people knew about them, sure, they knew they existed, but for the most part, no one just really cared all that much about these monuments. And so it was with Borobudur after the Islamic conversion of Java. The rainforest reclaimed it, and for centuries it sat abandoned and, by most people, forgotten about. But then, in the early 19th century, along came the British. They were engaged in their national pastime of fighting the French, and so the island of Java, inhabited by the Javanese and ruled by the Dutch, was of course the perfect target for the British war against the French. No, in all seriousness, the French were actually at the top of this particular colonial food chain. Even if the Dutch had colonised Java, the French, during the Napoleonic Wars, had actually annexed the Netherlands, so therefore Java was effectively now a French colony. So the British invaded, and successfully too. They took control of the island, and after doing so, the bloke they put in charge, a governor-general with the truly ludicrous name of Stamford Raffles. Stamford Raffles what, mate? A meat tray? This fella, right, he had a very strong interest in the history of Java. And after hearing tales of this lost temple, Raffles actually organised an expedition into the rainforest to rediscover Borobudur, and was very successful in unearthing and untreeing, I guess, this monument. A team of 200 people deforested the area around Borobudur. They burnt vegetation and dug away the volcanic ash to bring the temple back out into the light of day. Now, the British eventually withdrew from Java after the conclusion of the Napoleonic Wars, but the Dutch continued where Raffles had left off, and by the time we get to 1835, Borobudur had been taken back from Mother Nature. However, as you can imagine, it wasn't in very good condition, and it took a long time for the Dutch to decide what to do with this temple. They spent decades investigating and researching the site. At one point, they actually thought about disassembling the whole thing and transferring its famous reliefs into museums and leaving essentially nothing behind. Thankfully, this didn't happen, although some reliefs were looted, some statues were taken away, but for the most part, the monument remained intact, as intact as you can be after centuries in a rainforest, and thankfully the Dutch didn't go ahead with their plan to rip it apart like, I don't know, like a Lego set they were tired of. And eventually into the 20th century, the Dutch decided to stabilise and restore Borobudur. They worked to strengthen its foundations to avoid collapse. They bolstered its archways and other more delicate parts of the building. They improved its drainage. They removed loose stones and rubble. They restored statues and reliefs. And the whole place was just given a good thorough cleaning. And by 1911, after 4 years of hard yakka, Borobudur was looking terrific once again, restored to a good amount of its former glory. And then by 1915, it was falling apart again. Oops. These restoration efforts that the Dutch had undertaken hadn't been anywhere near sufficient to protect Borobudur long term. And some of the materials that had been used in strengthening it had actually damaged the stability of the structure long term. So instead of another huge, great big effort, which had seemed so utterly pointless once it had been done, there were smaller, slower paced restoration attempts made with Borobudur. But then even this came to a halt in the 1940s, thanks to the outbreak of the Second World War. And then after that, the Indonesian National Revolution that came afterwards. But after the revolution, the newly independent Indonesian government that was now responsible for Borobudur, they had to act, and they had to act very swiftly to save the monument, which once again was in a terrible state. And so they appealed to UNESCO. They got UNESCO in, and throughout the back half of the 20th century, an immense amount of work was done to save Borobudur, to prevent it from collapsing by stabilising it properly, and from there to thoroughly fix all of the issues that were plaguing this 1,200-year-old monument. And this involved, right, this conservation, this restoration effort involved, believe it or not, much of Borobudur being taken apart piece by piece, cleaned and treated, and then being put back together. It was not quite a ship of Theseus situation because they weren't using new materials to reconstruct the monument, but I don't think there's an ancient Greek parable that quite deals with that situation. I don't think there's a philosophical conundrum that posits the question of whether something is still the thing that it is if it is taken apart and cleaned. But that's what took place with Borobudur. And as this happened, brand new experimental techniques for protecting against ongoing damage were tested as part of this restoration effort. A modern drainage system was also installed. The whole thing, as I say, given a thorough cleaning from top to bottom. It was a massive effort, a truly colossal effort, and it cost millions and millions of dollars, almost $50 million US dollars in today's terms, with funding coming from France and from Germany, from Belgium, from Cyprus, and here we bloody go, mate, from Australia as well. Get around us. But it wasn't just very expensive, it was also very time-consuming. Work began in 1975 and continued into the 80s until 1982, but it was worth it. Because less than a decade later, Borobudur was listed as a UNESCO World Heritage Site. And even today, the site is a place of pilgrimage and celebration for Buddhists, with religious festivals regularly held there, and that's not to mention the millions of tourists that visit it every year. Borobudur remains an immensely popular attraction. However, there are still threats to its ongoing survival. The volcanoes near it still erupt every once in a while, notably and recently in 2010, and then again in 2014. The monument was blanketed in ash once again. And additionally, there have been plots made by various Islamic extremist groups to bomb Borobudur in recent years, although thankfully none have come to fruition. And finally, Borobudur is also a bit of a victim of its own success, in that the huge number of tourists that come and visit it every year aren't all that good for its long-term health. And I'm not just talking about the idiots that come and vandalise the place. Just the steps being walked up and down by millions of people every year is not good for their preservation. And so efforts these days have been made to preserve the monument, with things like the staircase is being covered by planks of wood so as to preserve the stone, as weird as that sounds. The site still requires very careful custodianship, as has been the case with most of the monuments we've talked about already and will talk about in future episodes. Anyway, today, Borobudur is a jewel in the crown of worldwide Buddhist monuments, surviving the harsh centuries, the rise and fall of cultures and religions, surviving natural reclamation and human conservation efforts. And it remains one of the most spectacular ancient monuments in Southeast Asia.
Streaming May 23rd, only on BET Plus. Miss Pat is back.
I'm excited.
And it's time for some grown-ass family time.
I am a man.
Oh, you a man?
That's right.
Then take my clothes off. You ain't pay for none of that on your back.
Dad, you can't ignore your mother forever. I've tried.
Would you like me to backhand you again?
The Miss Pat Show, streaming May 23rd on BET Plus. To sign up and learn more, visit BET.plus.
How about Cap'n Crunch's Crunch Berries with breakfast?
Whoa, Dad, we're on
Crunch Island. It's Jean-Luc Foote.
And he stole our crunch.
Quick, the zip line.
He's getting away.
Throw our last Crunch Berry.
No!
No one steals my Crunch Berries.
I think you mean my Crunch Berries. Choose your own Crunch Venture with Cap'n Crunch.